Hi, this is Jeff Tate from Queensryche, and you're listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast.
Hello, everybody. I am Lips from the band Anvil, and you are listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast. You know it.
This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the new stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix, right here, right now.
And if you didn't know it then, you certainly know it now. Welcome to the August show. Yes, we are 1 year old this month, so if you're hearing us for the first time, you're very welcome. And if you've heard every show before this one, God help you. This month, as you may have gathered, we're talking to Jeff Tate from Queensryche, who's played some tough gigs in his time, none tougher than last year in Iraq, though.
Standing outside watching the sun come up, and there's no birds, no nothing, no sound. Then all of a sudden, boom! 100 yards from where I'm standing, a mortar goes off. If there wasn't a building between me and that mortar, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. It was so huge.
Anvil have achieved one of the music world's most astounding comebacks of late, and lovable frontman Lips explains some remarkable audience reactions.
They pull the black cloth off the back line, into the march of the crabs. People are losing their shit, man. Yeah, you got kids, adults, old people. There were men in wheelchairs trying to get up.
Stampede are back after an almost 30-year layoff, and although the musicianship is spot on, not all of their faculties have survived the rigours of time.
We didn't have that pressure because we hadn't got a deal at the time, so we went in and rocked.
What did he say?
He said we went in and rocked.
And as usual, we'll have a news roundup and as much new release and tour information as we can cram into the next hour or so.
Oh,
classic rock and metal news.
Duff McKagan, no stranger to drug addiction, has commented on the passing of Amy Winehouse by defending some of the people around her who've been criticised for perhaps allowing the singer to sink so low. He claims he knows some of them and they were very stand-up people. He went on to say, "But in the end, it is just so sad to have lost this young woman to what will most likely be discovered to be drugs. She was a talent, she was different, she railed against the norm, she was a musical trailblazer. In the end, I cannot compare what I went through or experienced with what Amy Winehouse went through. I only know that addiction is a lonely and terrifying place to be. It's not glamorous, and addiction does not care if you are well known and rich or are a loner hermit with no dough. In Amy's case, like mine, I think she had some friends and family who tried and cared about her, but in the end fell short." Drummer Mike Portnoy, formerly of Dream Theater, of course, and more recently Avenged Sevenfold, has formed a new band with ex-Whitesnake and Thin Lizzy guitarist John Sykes. They're currently recording new material in LA. And 80s power metalers Jag Panzer are on the opposite side, have called it quits after 3 decades. "We're proud of every album we released and the support we've received from the heavy metal community," states guitarist and founder Mark Briody. "We've played so many places around the world and enjoyed every minute of it, but the time has come where we just cannot move forward as a band." The guitarist Christian Lessig left the band last month. It seems this was the final nail in the coffin, as it were. Metal Leviathan's Manowar have confirmed a series of UK dates for November, thanks to Metal Hammer, I think. 6 dates currently on the cards: Glasgow, Leeds, London, Cardiff, Dublin and Belfast, all in November, so get your tickets bought now. David Gilmour's son has been jailed for 16 months after admitting violent disorder during the student fees protests in London last December. If you recall, Charlie Gilmour, 21, was the one seen hanging from a Union Jack on the Cenotaph and later leaped onto the bonnet of the Jaguar, which was part of the Royal Convoy taking the Prince of Wales and Duchess of Cornwall to the Royal Variety performance that was attacked by demonstrators. Now, if you want to see something truly amazing, watch the YouTube video in our show notes this month, which shows the main stage at the Blues Fest in Ottawa collapsing during Cheap Trick set. The band had actually noticed something odd happening with the weather and had rushed from the stage just seconds before the entire roof collapsed. Amazingly, no one was killed, but the band's bus driver suffered a broken leg. Sad news was that former Motorhead guitarist Michael Burston, also known as Wurzel, sadly passed away in July, aged 61. The band issued the following statement: "We're greatly saddened to confirm that our longtime friend and comrade Wurzel died Saturday at his home. Wurz was pouring a Guinness and cracking a joke when he succumbed to a heart attack. At least we know he went with a smile. It's a cliche to say that words cannot describe how we feel, and in this case, other than one such as shit and awful and very, very sad, it is true they really can't. We all shared many, many great times together, and what he did for Motorhead is quite simply indelible." Lemmy added, "Wurzel was my friend and my brother, and he's never going to laugh with me again or bitch me out or do anything, and that truly and cosmically sucks. R.I.P. Wurz, Godspeed, good man."
You know it.
At the recent Sonisphere Festival at Nebworth here in the UK, the Big Four of Thrash, Metallica, Slayer, Megadeth and Anthrax, performed the Diamond Head song Am I Evil together and were joined on stage by Head's guitarist Brian Tatler. Lars Ulrich commented that if it wasn't for Tatler, there's a good chance that none of the other bands would have ever existed. Bret Michaels of Poison, currently on tour in the US supporting Motley Crue, of course, has had his lawsuit against the Tony Awards moved to New York. You may recall that in June 2009, while performing at the awards ceremony, Michaels was hit on the head by a set piece. He suffered some facial injuries, but is claiming it nearly killed him. "I have to confess, it nearly killed me laughing, to be honest. So if you haven't seen it yet, check out this month's show notes at classicrockpodcast.com. And Stephen Pearcy of Rat has released a solo single, Too Much Is Never Enough, which is available through iTunes. And Rat will be inactive for the rest of 2011 while he pursues other projects. Queensryche from Bellevue near Seattle formed in 1981 and since then have racked up 11 studio albums with sales worldwide in excess of 20 million units. Many of those were solely for the 1988 concept album Operation Mindcrime, which gave them their first US top 10 single and is often hailed as one of rock music's finest hours. They've never subscribed to a specific formula, and as such, although always a hard or progressive rock band, their constant reinvention has often left fans disgruntled with their latest offerings, only to come round in time once they've stopped trying to compare it to the last album. They've just finished touring the UK with Judas Priest, but last year they were in the Middle East playing shows to US forces in Iraq, resulting in them being shot at by insurgents as opposed to the audience, thankfully, but the result is much the same. Lead singer Jeff Tate is not your usual run-of-the-mill rock star frontman, far from it. Intelligent and forthright in his views, he holds strong opinions on many things, including the music industry and its future. I first asked him if their new album, Dedicated to Chaos, released in June through Roadrunner, had gone to plan.
Well, with each record, we sit down and we have discussions and talks about what we want to try to accomplish, what we want to try to achieve. And with this record, we wanted to stay away from writing a theme, you know, or a concept. We wanted to kind of stretch out musically and not have to feel constrained by a story. And so that was one of the main concerns with everyone. So we did that. We accomplished that. Two, we wanted to approach our instruments different, play them differently, just try to find other ways of doing what it is we do. You know, after years and years of doing things, you get in the habit of always going to a certain chord or when you write or using the same guitar or something like that. And we really tried to stay away from that kind of thing. We wanted to approach our songwriting different. And that was mainly after Scott, our drummer, and Eddie, our bass player, came in with some material that got us all fired up, which was the jumping off point of the composing for the record. But we recognized the fact that, it'd be nice to, you know, have the bass line be the rhythm of the song rather than having the guitar be the rhythm like we've always done. You know, let's let the bass do the talking and let the guitar do the accents, you know, and the pre-sounds and the interesting sounds, the candy, you know. And we wanted to try to play around with, you know, the term rock and roll. Rock is the downbeat, right? The roll is the offbeat. It's what gives the music this push and pull, and makes it kind of sexy and swing. Well, Queensrÿche records have never really rolled very much. They've been very rock.
Right.
So we wanted to introduce some roll into it and give the music some sass, you know, some contemporary feel to it. So I think we accomplished that on quite a few songs too. So in our minds, it's a very successful record musically. You know, we set out to accomplish certain goals, and we did.
There is something slightly different about it, and when you explain the drum and bass thing, it makes sense that the other instruments, I suppose the guitar specifically, is almost accompanying them in certain areas.
Right.
It must be exciting to be able to progress the sound with the people who are already in the band, as opposed to having to take a change of direction because personnel has changed. It must be quite gratifying after all this time to be able to do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one thing I love about playing with this band is they could pretty much play anything you throw at them, and they'll give it their interpretation, their spin, which I like too. They're not just playing it note for note how you present it. They're giving it their own certain something that's special, you know, and that really plays into the idea of collaboration, which is something that we all really enjoy. Mm. We were sitting around having conversations one day, and we were talking about how we'd all noticed that people listen to music a lot wearing headphones, you know, plugged into their iPod as they're walking down the street or in their car even, traveling. You always see people with headphones in their ears. And we spend the majority of our lives with headphones in our ears as well, because that's how you write music, you know, is you're constantly listening to it on headphones. And we thought, well, why don't we just approach this record like that and, you know, make it interesting for people to listen to on headphones, give it some depth, some layering, put interesting effects in that shift the stereo spectrum, and just make it oriented towards headphones. Why not do that? So we did.
Do you pay much attention to CD and record sales these days?
No. Coming from the era we came from, today's CD sales are just a joke by comparison, you know. In everybody's world, all musicians are in bands are suffering from sales too. Was it 96% drop in sales last year for CDs? Yeah, it's staggering. It's just the changing industry, you know. If people can get something for free, they're going to. It's just kind of human nature. And there's no way to stop the piracy. It's just always going to happen, I think. So my prediction, you know, watching from the inside, is that in the next, I would say, 5 years, all the record companies are going to be gone. There's no money in it for them, you know. It's completely been gutted. So how are they going to make money if they're not selling product, you know? So I think music's going to be free in the next few years. And really, it's an exciting time because we can all reinvent ourselves. We can reinvent the business in a new way. And it's happening. You know, people are talking about it a lot, and it's a major concern. So it's the focus and the energy is moving in that direction right now. So it's a fascinating time.
It is, and the reason I touched on you talking about the production and listening to it headphones is there is a view that people will get fed up of MP3 downloads because the quality isn't there, and that they will want something which does sound better, and therefore producing an album which does sound better, which you might actually have to pay for, is the model now. You can get something for free, but if you want the premium version, you have to pay a little bit for it. And now, ironically, with the web, which I guess killed it initially, you've got that direct access to do it yourselves and perhaps don't need the labels.
Exactly. The sound quality thing is, I don't even think it's worth debating. You know, people hear music differently. They listen to music differently. Some people hear music in the detail that's there. They can follow all the instruments and tell you what notes instruments are playing. Other people hear it as a wall of sound. Some people just feel it and they move to it, you know. Some people only hear the kick drum, you know. So debate all you want to about the quality of listening to music, MP3 versus vinyl versus CD. It's an endless debate. I hope it never goes back to the way it was. It's way too much money to spend to make a record. It used to cost us $300,000-$500,000 to make a record. You know, now we can work anywhere we want for nothing. Everything we need is in our laptop, in our little suitcase that has our special stuff with it, and our instruments, and that's all. You can give us. We can make a record in this room we're talking in right now. We work on buses, hotel rooms, backstage at shows. It's great. It makes music so much more immediate, you know. And without the record companies in the way, music will be up on the web every day. New music for people to listen to. Think of that. That's amazing. The record companies slow everything down. They can barely keep out of their own way, you know.
What prompted the trip to the Middle East last year?
We've been wanting to do that for years. It's really difficult to go to the Middle East and play. It's not like you can just ask your agent, hey, book us a gig, you know. Can't do that, especially Iraq, you know, it's military controlled. So you have to get approved, you know, through the military. And you have to have the right contacts and know the right people to get in there. So we'd been working on it for several years and pretty much given up because we just couldn't get there. And out of the blue, we got a call from this guy from Lone Wolf Productions, Jeff. And he called him and said, hey, I take bands into Iraq. Are you interested in going? And we said, absolutely. He said, well, can you go in 2 weeks? And we said, absolutely. We dropped everything and went. And we were over there for a two-week tour. And we went to seven or eight different bases around the country as guests of the military, and they flew us into all the different places. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. And I would do it again tomorrow if they would let us.
Because you had a fairly major incident while you were over there as well, didn't you? There was a...
Oh, the mortar attack, yeah. yeah, that was a bit unnerving. It really brought home the reason why that we were there in the first place. But it's interesting, every base that we had gone to previously was like orderly, calm, business as usual kind of base. It felt like you were touring a base in Texas in the U.S. or something, you know. Safe, no problem, you know. The day we flew into Camp Stryker, it was weird from the start. I was in the cockpit that day. It was my turn to sit in the cockpit. And the C-140 is a giant transport airplane. It has all our gear in the back and our crew and the band and everybody and some soldiers as well. We take off, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm looking at the birthplace of modern civilization here between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, right? And I'm in heaven because I'm a closet anthropologist, you know. So I'm looking at all these sites, you know, that I recognize from maps and things like this. And the pilot and the co-pilot are talking to each other. And the co-pilot says, so you're going to go up the river route? And the pilot says, well, I got a weird feeling. And he just kind of dives off to the left a little bit, skirts in between the two rivers. And all of a sudden, these missiles are going off around us. Whew! And the co-pilot says, wow, way to go. You missed that one, you know. So he cruises down the middle of these two rivers because it's the safest route. And we finally land at Camp Stryker. And this place is like a war zone. I mean, there's bombs going off. We go off the back of the airplane and they hustle. This group of soldiers comes out and gets us. They hustle us into this bunker. And we spend 2 hours in the bunker underground waiting for them to make the place safe. And we're all like, whoa, what's going on? You know, we got, you know, flak vests, mandatory helmets, you know, this kind of thing. We're just a bunch of musicians sitting in this, you know, underground bunker. That's how it started off. And then the show was great. We had a great show. And what's weird is you can't, all the shows are outdoors because they don't have facilities for indoor concerts. And they just make you a stage and there's no lights. Because you're a target if there's lights. This particular base, you could see the city, the Iraqi city, right, is right next to it.
Wow.
You know, so that's where the mortars were coming from. They were just launching mortars into the base. And it was weird because you'd be playing the song and all of a sudden you'd see... off in the distance. And the soldiers that were with us said, that happens all the time, just get used to it, don't let it bother you, you know. So the next morning, we finished the show, and the next morning, I was up with the sun, and we had a 6 o'clock leaving time. So I'm standing outside the barracks, standing there in my boxer shorts, and it's already 95 degrees out, and the sun's baking, and I got a yogurt out of the refrigerator. And I'm standing outside eating this yogurt, watching the sun come up, and there's no birds, no nothing, no sound. Then all of a sudden, boom! 100 yards from where I'm standing, a mortar goes off. And if there wasn't a building between me and that mortar, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. It was so huge and concussive that the ground shook, and I dropped the yogurt, and I nearly wet my pants. But again, soldiers came running out of nowhere, you know, grabbing me. Okay, into the bunker, into the bunker. Where's your helmet? Where's your helmet? Came home, my wife was going, you gotta decompress, man. You're way too macho. All I wanted to watch was Schwarzenegger movies, you know.
You've spoken about music being art, and you're kind of well placed to say it, because just as paintings in different styles can take time for people to appreciate, so it is with some of your work. I mean, Promised Land, for example, wasn't, you know, a lot of people come back to it and didn't like it at the time. Do you get impatient waiting for people to come around to some of the stuff that you've done?
No, not anymore. I'm sort of used to it. It's been happening our entire career. With each release, it seems like the majority of what we hear is negativity from people. You know, oh, it's not like the Warning album. No, that was Rage. And then when Mindcrime came out, what's this? It's not like Rage. Rage was really cool. You know, and it's just happened every record. So it doesn't really count anymore for us. We just kind of know what we like and we know what moves us. And that's the only criticism that we really adhere to is our own.
So we've had 30 years of Queensryche.
Yeah.
We've got a new album. What's next?
31 years.
He's a card, isn't he? Thanks to Jeff for taking the time to chat. The first track off Dedicated to Chaos is actually my favourite. It opens the live set for them at the moment too, so it's appropriately entitled Get Started.
Thank you.
Stephen Adler was of course the original drummer with Guns N' Roses, but after recording just one track from the band's Use Your Illusion project, he was unceremoniously booted out, reportedly because of his increasingly destructive heroin addiction. Being kicked out of Guns N' Roses for doing drugs was a bit like asking a cat not to catch mice, so he was understandably miffed, and many of the subsequent years have been filled with court cases to recoup unpaid royalties and craving recognition for his contribution to possibly the best debut album ever made, Appetite for Destruction. Most recently, though, Adler has released an autobiography, taken the occasional swipe at the current Guns lineup, but more healthily started the band Adler's Appetite and begun touring again. His addictions, though, have plagued his life, and he is, as we speak, taking part in a second series of the US TV show Celebrity Rehab, where his appearance first time round produced some of the most shocking images you're likely to see. Check the show notes this month if you don't believe me. I was, though, lucky enough to catch him on the phone a while ago, alongside touring bass player Chips Enough, longtime friend and leader of the band Enough's Enough. Please bear in mind that Stephen now has a marked speech impediment, the result of a stroke suffered thanks to his past drug habit.
It's like 20 years later, I'm getting some love and some respect for, you know, my contribution to Guns N' Roses. And it's a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it.
I mean, it's incredible, really. I mean, I saw some live footage of you recently, and your timing is still spot on, which is unbelievable after everything you've been through, like a stroke. I mean, you must be, like, indestructible.
You'd be surprised what the body can put up with. You know, you would think it's easy to kill yourself. It's not. The body can put up with a lot of bullshit. I mean, I'm lucky and thankful I came out of it with just a stroke. You know, a mild stroke, I'd be learning to speak again. I'm thankful that I'm capable of the touring, and people, you know, enjoy the music still. That's a rare thing. You know, you do your homework, be prepared, and be truly confident that will attract success like a magnet. Believe me.
Well, it looks like it, because, I mean, people are turning out and people are desperate to see it. And you've got, there's the new single, which is just on iTunes. Is it Alive is the new one?
Well, we got Alive is the first one. We have two new ones, Fading and Stardog. You can get those on iTunes, too. Hold on one second, Oliver. I'm going to give you a chippy.
Oliver, I got to tell you, how you doing, my friend?
Hey, how you doing, Chip? Nice to speak to you, man.
I got to add on to what Steven was saying about the shows. Every show's been a sellout, jam-packed now. We're not playing arenas right now as we should be, but it's an arena act playing clubs, and we got 400, 500, 600 people a night piling in. They're singing the songs of not only the stuff that Steven wrote with Guns N' Roses, but the new material that Adler's Appetite has just put out. And we hope to have a record out sometime this year. You know, we're putting one song out at a time because that's the way the world is right now. iTunes, Rhapsody, eMusic, all these music sites.
Yeah, yeah.
And we want to accommodate the fans as fast as we can. And I expect big things to happen for this band right now. Steven's in a real good place in his life. I'm glad to be a part of it. And we got a strong rhythm section every night. The shows are strong. And the fans are speak volumes. I let, you know, go get on YouTube if you want to see any of the shows. And I'll give you an insight on what we're doing right now in this tour right now, driving around in an Oscar Mayer wiener wagon for a month.
And this is the single Alive from Adler's Appetite, and if you're a fan of early Guns N' Roses, it should ring a few bells.
Sounds keep haunting me.
Stampede released just one full album, Hurricane Town, through Polydor back in 1983, after which vocalist Reuben Archer, his stepson guitarist Lawrence Archer and the rest of the band went their separate ways. Fast forward to 2011, and after 28 years off, they decided to make that troublesome second record. Released in May this year, A Sudden Impulse did way more than deliver a few reminiscent riffs and metal melodies. It's actually a collection of tracks guaranteed to prick up the ears of even the most doubting Thomas. I was treated to an audience with all five members before a recent show in London and first asked Lawrence whose crazy idea this all was.
The initial reason the band came back together again was that Rock Candy re-released the studio album. We were thinking at the time about releasing the live album, and then we thought we'd do a sort of one-off gig to support the album, and that sort of snowballed into other warm-up gigs. Then we got asked to do other gigs, and then it got, you know, it just went on, and then we started doing the album, and that's how this lineup evolved, really, out of doing the album, I think.
So when did the songs get written for this album then?
Lawrence already had four or five songs together, and we went down, started recording it down in Weston, Supermare, but it wasn't quite right, and then we tried it down in Devon, and that wasn't quite right, so we got it all back up to the Midlands and into the studio where Magnum record. And Lawrence spent some time up there, but he was under a lot of pressure with his work, and at the end of a week, when he was only supposed to be there for 2 days, he turned around and said, I'm going to sell my guitars. I thought, terrific. And then we sat around for about 6 months, nothing happening, and, you know, money had been spent, and I just thought, we've got to get this going, and so I said to Lawrence, well, you know, I know a guy that can come in and finish this, do you mind? And he said, no. So we did, and Chris came round one day and said, how are you going to do that live? Because you've got harmonies all over. And he said, I'd be really interested. And so basically that's how the thing got done. We just wrote a lot of stuff very quickly then and went in and just did it. Rock Candy liked it and put it out, and it's just got rave reviews. I mean, we can't believe what I never thought it was going to get that, you know. Mm. So now we're in doing the next one.
When I got the album, I had no expectations of it at all, and it's a great record. Were you surprised at how good it turned out in the end, given all the history that you've just mentioned?
I think we were very critical of it to start with, while we were writing and rehearsing it and just trying to get the songs together, and we were very critical of it, and we were unsure, but we eventually managed to cement what we thought was good, and yeah, it's just been fantastic, the reaction. Really makes you feel good that the people are out there enjoying it all over the place, and it was a surprise as much to us, but I think it's got kind of a fresh feel about it.
Well, that was
as well as maintaining the, you know, the hard rock elements, it's got a fresh feel as well.
So the big thing is when you come back up, you know, after 28 years to do something like this, you think, how should we sound, you know, because that last album of ours was quite produced and it's got a big ambient sound.
A lot of bands these days spend years making albums, especially when they come back. I mean, you know, basically what happened was is I had songs written that I brought to the table initially, and then it was all a bit bitty, really. That's the only reason that we felt critical of it, is because it wasn't a straightforward process of one bunch of guys writing a bunch of songs, going and recording them, walking away going, yeah, that's how it is. It was bits of songs were recorded with those guys, bits of songs were recorded or changed in the studio, and it all came together in the end.
Obviously, we speak to a lot of bands who are not beholden to a label, and there's no agenda of how it has to sound in a specific way. And the end result is usually a cracking album, because people are just going, let's just go in and
do... They're not trying to stick to a formula, are they, where the record company's saying, I want singles off you. We didn't have that pressure because we hadn't got a deal at the time. So we went in and rocked.
What did he say? He said, we went in and rocked. Stevie J's from Aldridge.
I think that's the whole point, actually. You know, when we first were signed to Polydor, they saw a commercial viability in us, and all they wanted was singles. We never were going to get the tour support that a band, rock band, needs, you know, to go out on tour to promote the record. It was just going to be a single, put in the charts if it sinks or swims, you know. As Lawrence said in another interview, we never had an A&R guy at Polydor. We had a label manager, and then they actually signed an A&R guy, and he brought another band in, and that's where all the money went. What we should have done is just down tools and gone off and got another deal, but I'd had an accident and I just didn't feel like doing it, and it was... The main thing was we had all the ideas, we had all the material, we knew what we were doing. There's two things that happen in this business: the right time for you, and you need everything going for you. And we had everything, but we didn't have the right people behind us. And then along came punk, new wave, and everything else just buried us. So now, I think it's the right time. It seems to be. Some guy wrote, he gave the albums 7 stars out of 10, but he said we weren't doing anything new. Well, but we're not trying to do anything new,
no,
are we?
No.
I mean, why would we want to do that? Because the people that were into us, and I never realised quite how many there were, now it's all coming out of the woodwork, and you realise their kids are grown up. They want to go out, they've got a bit of money. If they've got money to spend, they want to go and see bands they like then, not stuff that's out today. And then their kids get into it. And it's like, it has all come back quite a lot, I think, you know.
Air guitars at the ready from the new album Sudden Impulse. This is Send Me Down an Angel. Steve Lips Kudlow and Rob Reiner met as school kids in 1973, started a band and vowed to do it until they were old men. And they meant it. 30 years later, a fan from back in the day discovered they were still playing and decided to make a movie about them. In 2008, the documentary Anvil, The Story of Anvil, aired at the Sundance Film Festival and nearly caused a riot. It was, on the face of it, the tale of how a Canadian rock band nearly made it in the 80s, only to fade into obscurity. What the film actually presented was a tale of triumph through perseverance, determination, and the sheer stubborn unwillingness to admit defeat. At times funny, at others heartbreaking, the film has crossed all boundaries and reminded many of us of the importance of family and friends, and that happiness comes from within, not from a bank account. Since the movie aired,
Anvil's popularity has gradually soared, partly because people fell in love with the characters, partly because some of us remembered they weren't half bad. So now that the dust has well and truly settled and it's time to release Juggernaut of Justice, their first album since the movie hit, is the band under pressure to deliver on the hype? Lips, as always, tells it like it is.
This was the moment. Necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it? We had to do it. We had to. For pure survival. No choice. It's that or we perish. No doubt about it. After all the recognition that we attained from that movie and failing musically, we're done. Anybody would, you know that. And we wouldn't let that happen. I'm not going to let that happen. Not after 37 fucking years.
Well, that was the question, because I remember seeing some of the interviews just after the movie came out, or not so long after the movie came out, and you guys were saying the next album's going to be called Juggernaut, the songs are all written. But that was quite a while ago, so why the sort of delay between that and coming out?
Time.
Right.
In 2008, when the movie ran at Sundance, it took off. We started playing every music festival, film festivals, in theaters, not in a concert hall, not in a club, in a fucking movie theater. We went on a promotional tour of the United States before the thing hit the theaters. We called it the Popcorn Tour. Unbelievable, man. You know, the movie would play. Next thing you know, the house lights in the theater come on, and I'm running up the aisle. They pull the black cloth off the back line, into the March of the Crabs. People are losing their shit, man. And the demographics of it, it's not normal. It's not a metal crowd. You have people that go to movies. Yeah, you got kids, adults, old people. I mean, we went and did the Michael Moore Film Festival in Traverse City, Michigan. And there were men in wheelchairs trying to get up and doing devil horns. Never mind never seeing a metal band before, but being that moved by it.
So how about now then? I mean, is the audience kind of back to what I suppose you say is a more traditional metal audience, or have they...
Yeah, it is back more to the traditional audience, particularly in Europe, because that's what happened. It really, really ignited the metal audience, obviously. But because of the statement, the movie is a statement of perseverance. It's almost like a hymn to the genre. You can't kill metal. No one ever will. It is the surviving music, and that is incredible. We didn't make it because of a commercial hit on the radio. We made it for perseverance, right? Perseverance, determination, and just raw fucking, I want to do it.
It could have been about
anything.
Yeah, it was.
The metal thing was the backdrop.
When you were recording Juggernaut, did you feel a certain amount of pressure because you knew there was going to be a huge audience for that record?
Yes and no. To explain it the easiest way, all the peripheral bullshit was gone. Normally when you make a record, you worry about, is there going to be a label? Is there going to be an audience? Is there going to be a producer? Is there going to be a manager? Are we ever going to play any gigs? All that shit gone. Only thing I had to worry about, put the best album I've ever written together. Now, the environment was bright, hopeful, like it was in Metal on Metal and Forge and Fire, because at that point, the environment was the same. No peripheral bullshit. Every time all the stuff on the outside was no good, it rotted it. It deterred it, it made it hard, and it made it very hard. I mean, the prime example, in 1989 to 90, in that area, we recorded the album Worth the Wait. During that period of time, my first marriage that took place during the heyday, so to speak, was falling apart. Rob's father died. Everything, you look at the titles, Love Me When I'm Dead, On the Way to Hell, The Sadness Will Last Forever, Embalmer. Not exactly When Hell Breaks Loose or I do it my way, fucking A. You know, it wasn't about that. It was about all the external. And the environment was dark and full of death and loss. So was the music. This album, our environment was full of hope, happiness, fulfillment. What do you get? A great album. One and one is still two.
Yeah. In terms of the industry, obviously the film was very scathing on labels and the industry in general. Have you found it, that it's changed now? Obviously, a larger label, but are people a bit more wary because it's Anvil and you're on the radar in such a huge way? Or has it got better generally, do you think?
I think it's for us, it's generally gotten better. Still not a major label, because the real truth is, that's not the kind of music we do. You know, it's not about radio play. It's not about becoming Bon Jovi, you know. So, is it better? Yes, of course it's better. I don't have a day job anymore. That in itself is the most winning aspect, isn't it? I make a living from being an Anvil. I'm living the dream. I'm making music for my living. What more can someone ask? From my perspective, I haven't changed at all. But I wouldn't. Why would I? See, because to me, I've been successful all along. And the reason I say that, success for me was identifying my identity. When I no longer had to play cover songs and it was all about whatever I wanted to do, that was the day I became successful. Whether I sell a million records or 10 records is no effect on me whatsoever. I could give two fucks. Because the real truth is, at the end of the day, especially now, I'm not making the money out of that anyway. I'm in the same business as my dad. He was a tailor. I sell t-shirts. I sell garments. And my music is nothing more, nothing less than the advertisement to do that. That's what it's become. You can get music for free. Go sell air. Go sell water. Although they're able to sell water. God only knows why. But if you put a nice label enough on it, you make enough a nice enough album cover, people will pay for it. A good enough package. That's a good collector's item.
Even though we're talking about the movie, are we at a point now where the questions are starting to come purely about the new music and Anvil from now onwards, and that the movie will kind of go into the background?
No, the movie will not go into the background. So that's the thing. Many people, of course, at the onset, 2 minutes of fame. Just a movie, so what? No. Wrong. It isn't just a movie. It's real life. It's a movie about real life, my real life. I'm not dead yet, so it's not going to go away. And it's not fading. It hasn't at all. We're talking about something that came out in 2008, and we're still talking about it. I'm still doing one of thousands and thousands of interviews about the movie, and people are discovering that movie every fucking day. If you look at the situation with Spinal Tap, they just did a 25-year anniversary, and they're not even a real band. And we meant something. There's certain aspects of the reasons why. Never going to happen again. You met the film director when he was 15 years old, a punter, at the Marquee Club here in London, England. And then 25, 27 years later, the guy's a screenwriter for Steven Spielberg and makes a movie about his favorite band. Had I not let him into the change room and been a dickhead, there'd be no movie. Had I made shit music, that guy would never have come into the change room. So everything is connected and everything has a reason for happening and for being. And being at the right place at the right time is what it's all about. Just like Lemmy said, if you're not at the right place at the right time, it'll never happen. Everything has to align. The situation is that the movie got huge, the band is a living, breathing entity and is not going away. And the movie follows it, shadows us everywhere.
Do you look at Juggernaut as being, because it is a great album, and it's clearly...
Because it had to be. It had to be. Let's put it this way. I was so sure. I was so dead set sure that the movie was going to be a success that during the editing, I wrote the album. Because I knew I'm not going to have a fucking minute to do this. Once that thing hits, we're not going to be able to even go to rehearsal. There's not going to be rehearsal. We're going to be who the fuck knows where. And that's exactly what happened. It hit Sundance, and then the next thing you know, it's fucking film festivals all over the world. There's no time, and that's a good thing. You know, we got all the songs. Let's go in and record. We got an album. We're going to call it Juggernaut of Justice. We got all this stuff ready, and it's like, sorry, guys, you got to go here. Oh, sorry, guys, you got another tour. Sorry, guys, you got to go to South America. Sorry, guys, you got to go to Australia. Sorry, guys, you got to go to Japan. Sorry, no time to go record. We'll find some time. Maybe next year. Maybe next year. And we're going, what? And they go, no, man, you don't get it. It's like, you're busy, man. There's a demand for you guys. You got to fulfill the demand. And what it became at first, obviously, many people watch the movie go, this isn't real. Get the fuck out of here. It's Spinal Tap. It's not real. All that did was open up the doors. Let's go prove it. And people wanted to see the proof. Let's see this thing. It wasn't just writing another album. It's prove you're a good band. Prove you're a good live band. And we had to go do that too. You know, got hired for Download. You better fucking do good, man. They're throwing you into the lion's den, man. It's one thing to get the opportunity, but it's another thing to make the most of it and for it to work. We've been extraordinarily lucky and worked very, very hard. You know, that's the way I see it.
Was On Fire from Anvil's new album Juggernaut of Justice, and having seen them live recently, I urge everyone else to do so at their earliest opportunity. Just time to tell you that if you fancy a gig this month, you can see Tank, who start their War Machine tour in the UK and Northern Europe. The Choir Boys still have a couple of dates left if you're quick. The Cambridge Rock Festival runs from the 4th to the 7th of August and features over 70 bands. Wacken Open Air, the mighty Wacken Open Air Festival in Germany, is on the 5th to the 7th of August, where you and 100,000 other people can see, amongst others, Judas Priest, Ozzy Osbourne and Tokyo Blade. And finally, if you hadn't noticed, Iron Maiden have just 3 UK dates left in August on their Final Frontier World Tour. New releases are few this month, but I would point out that Def Leppard released their first live album, Mirrorball, from which we had Photograph at the top of the show. The album also includes 3 new studio tracks and is available to buy, yes, buy, with an excellent bonus DVD. That's it for now. See you next month.
You know it.